Prevention Work Group informational meeting, September 15th, 2014.
Thank you.
So who do we have on the phone? Okay.
This is Ellen Clem with the Oregon Department of Justice, Office of the Attorney General.
Okay. Anyone else?
Yeah, Jeff Brandon.
Hey, Jeff.
I was with the Governor's Commission, but I'm off the commission now, and
You're freelancing it?
Just Jeff Brandon.
Yep.
Okay.
And Michelle Bass, the attorney.
Okay. All right, anybody else? Great. And then starting over on the right, Gordon, want to introduce yourself?
Grover Simmons, Independent Adult Care Home Association.
Mary Yeager, Long-Term Care Ombudsman.
Joe Greenman, Oregon Healthcare Association.
Val Hoyle, Representative District 14.
Vic Gilliam, Co-Chair.
Laura Johnson from the Oregon State Bar.
Fred Steele, Department of Human Services.
Betsy Steinberg, Pioneer Trust Bank.
Lori Rowe, OSU Federal Credit Union.
I'm Claudia Burton, and I'm a trial judge with the Marion County Circuit Court, although I am required to say that I do not officially speak for the Oregon Judicial Department.
I'm Chana Newell, I'm your staff.
Fantastic, and thank you, Chana, for getting all of this information together. With that, we'd like an update from the subcommittee on definitions. Fred Steele and Laura Johnson with initial assessment. Do you want?
Yeah, can I jump in?
Oh, there you are. It's like, where are you? He's not
over. Yeah, we're partnering over on your left side here.
Okay.
So the subcommittee on definitions met, and as the PowerPoint slides handout identified, five times between June and now. I think our last time officially was last week. Looked at a number of definitions specifically within the elder abuse statute to identify any potential areas of improvement. As we looked at those definitions, though, we realized that some of them would be more tinkering with improvements in the definitions without any real prevention of elder abuse goals, I would say. Chose to not address some of them. A couple of the definitions would be larger undertakings and looking at broader adult abuse issues, I would say, across maybe facility types, all facility types. So a little more complex. And so with that, within that context, we started looking at some additional topics. If you look on the slide number two on the handout, looking at initial assessments with APS, looking at the vulnerability of elderly persons and whether that was something that we wanted to address currently in statutes. And anybody 65 or older in the elder abuse statute is automatically deemed vulnerable. So there was a topic worth discussion to assess prioritizing of APS cases and resources. And we'll get into this, looked a little bit at the sex abuse definition and what we had changed actually in February. There was just a minor tweak that was needed to correct, an error that resulted from that change in February. That's a recommendation we'll get into. Also, kind of adverse event tracking in facilities and whether there's a relationship or not a relationship to abuse cases. It's a conversation that we started to get into specifically to retake up work that this work group did here in the last couple years and recommendation to the resident, to create the Resident Safety Review Council. So we had Bethany Walmsley come back and give a presentation to the subgroup to just identify if there's something more or additional that we can do within as a follow-up to the recommendations that came from that. and please jump in, Laura, at any point. I'm just kind of flying through these slides. And Chana, thank you for putting these slides together. It's wonderful. So for the initial assessment, going on to page two of the handout and would be the third slide, the initial assessment concept of what we were looking at, I kind of touched on that, looking at vulnerable situations, not necessarily identifying those individuals, even 65 or older, that are vulnerable adults. It was a term I think most of us in the subgroup didn't like, actually categorizing adults as vulnerable. But if you look at the situation in context and in whole, you know, the actual vulnerable situation was something that we wanted to address and look at, whether there was a potential proposal or recommendation to balance kind of the safety approach and the, I would broadly say, a paternalistic approach that's currently in statute for the elder abuse, you know, response requirements for adult protective services or law enforcement, balancing that with, you know, the independence and self-determination of seniors. Very difficult concept to tackle, quite frankly, from our work group, looking at, you know, the potential to miss cases. We were very concerned in some of our conversations, and I would say that was the biggest concern, is that we were able to, working with legislative counsel, come up with a draft concept that I think could be workable, but really was opening the door to missing cases, quite frankly, at the APS level, at the local level, and maybe not due to error, but just not enough safeguards built in to ensure that cases of actual abuse and the more subtle vulnerability, say like undue influence type situations, we were concerned that we might miss those. And so I think we actually get into what our outcomes are, or maybe this is where I get into the outcomes of this particular concept. And I'm kind of jumping on the slides here. But what I'd say is that through the conversations of our subgroup, felt that this was a concept, since it is more of a balancing of independence with safety, that it arguably wasn't going to, it was more abstract in how we would actually be preventing elder abuse through this concept. Felt that it was a concept that may be better left to a proposal from the Department of Human Services, something that needs to be worked on, something that, you know, an idea that's come to my head in thinking this through even further, coming to this meeting and this discussion today. I would say that there's a need for continued improvement, and I know that the DHS Office of Adult Abuse Prevention Investigations have been doing this, continue development and improvement of training, and they've done a wonderful job in the last 2 years and built up a core curriculum and some amazing training here in the last couple of years with that office. I think that there's more that can be done, and probably building up to this type of a concept. So there's just some more work that needs to be done before I think going forward, maybe better identification of how it can and will improve, you know, the prevention of elder abuse. Laura, do you want to jump in?
Well, I think part of our concern was for adults in transition who are over 65 but have not yet made it to a residential care facility, who are living on their own, might meet the definition of independent, but still have some special needs and may require some special protections. And we had no one on our committee that was actively involved in the investigation process currently at DHS, other than Fred through his policy.
As close as I get to.
Yeah. And so I think our thought was that if DHS wanted to make a recommendation as to how to handle their investigation process to parse out protecting the vulnerable but also allowing independent decision making, they might be better suited to sort of drawing that fine line.
I want to take any questions on this particular concept. I don't know if anybody has any.
Anybody on the committee? Anybody on the phone?
So moving on, and on page 3 of the handout, the subcommittee work that we looked at, the sex abuse definition that I indicated, at DHS and the implementation of what we passed in February in House Bill 4151 and improvements in the sex abuse definition under elder abuse, one of the things that we were trying to correct was recognizing consensual relationships, and again deferring, this was just one of the pieces we were correcting in that sex abuse definition, and recognizing consensual relationships, independence, self-determination of some seniors in certain caregiving settings. But in the process, we actually made it, and this came to light in the rulemaking process and the implementation of House Bill 4151, and in particular in our rural APS areas and those outside of the more populous areas of the state, recognized that there might be a spouse that's working at a long-term care facility, in particular assisted living facility or an adult foster home, and that their spouse, the spouse may become a resident of that facility. The way our definition worked was if they engaged in sexual relationship at the facility while the one spouse was a worker, one spouse was a resident or is a resident, that would actually be sex abuse. And so we're trying to fix that and recognize spousal relationships trump. And that wouldn't deter from the rest of the sex abuse definition that still recognizes non-consensual relationships. I mean, this is still just referring to consensual relationships. So hopefully, that is a recommendation we are making from our subgroup, is to tweak that definition a little bit further from what we did in February. Any questions on that? And then moving on for the adverse events. And so bottom of page 4 in that first slide, and what we were looking at here, the slide does address what I had mentioned, that the resident safety review council and the chair of that, Bethany Walmsley, with the Patient Safety Commission, reviewed the report that came from that council, and that again was a byproduct of this work group and the elder abuse work group, looking at again adverse events that occur in facilities, and using that term as defined currently by the Patient Safety Commission and work that they do in hospital settings, and recognizing, and so they had done a review and a report, and I think we're all up to date on that, looking at both substantiated abuse and non-substantiated abuse cases and making some recommendations from that report. There's still the potential when looking at incidents in general, whether abuse incidents or any incident that occurs in a facility, to better track those incidents, to maybe look at those incidents in the aggregate as they do at the Patient Safety Commission. This is my view and opinion, I will state, that I think that there's potential to use that data, collect that data to begin with, use it for quality of care improvement efforts. And so we started this discussion of what possibilities, what options, or what type of a recommendation might we be able to make from the subgroup. I think there's a number of options at the top of page 5 in the slide there. It talks about a need to distinguish maybe starting point between adverse events, abuse, a possible parallel track or single track. I mean, there's a number of options I think that we were discussing and considering, but only briefly. It came up in one or two of our subgroup meetings out of the 5. And really the recommendation we have is we want to continue the conversation with this subgroup. I mean, there's more work to be done, and we look forward to continuing the conversation.
Fred, if you would, can you just give us an example again of an adverse event? It's always good context for people to hear this.
Yes, thank you. So, Matt, the one that always comes to mind for me is, a prescription medication for a resident that maybe is given to the wrong resident, adverse event. I'm trying to remember. With that question, I should have looked up the definition of adverse event. And I might look to Joe over there. Yeah. He knew I was coming at him. Yeah. I'm trying to think what the actual definition of adverse event is.
Off the top of my head, you put me on the spot.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
But, Fred's on track.
Yeah.
Falls, medication errors, essentially things that are accidental in nature, and deserve some sort of investigation, transparency, and accountability, but could potentially be addressed via an investigatory process, getting to the root cause of the accident and potentially improving systems, as opposed to using sort of a punitive approach, depending, of course, on the underlying issues associated with the incident.
Yeah, and so going off of that, one of the slides here on the bottom of page 4 shows that, the Resident Safety Review Council found that 35% of abuse reports contained adverse events. I think that those reports, though, were both unsubstantiated as well as substantiated cases. I mean, the adverse event context, my recollection of the work that is my part with the Resident Safety Review Council, and I didn't get a chance to look at the specific percentages here in the last few days, but it it does capture both. And so there's just, there is more to be had in that discussion, especially when you think of, for me, at least when I think of those adverse events that are unsubstantiated abuse cases and we're not really doing much with, or if they're not a licensing violation with our licensing and regulatory office. So for quality of care improvement efforts and facilities, it's a conversation that with our subgroup we plan to continue. So,
and if I may add, it may be a fairly large discussion because there is an overlap between what is neglect and what is adverse events, and sometimes an adverse event can be both. And there is some concern about how to set up a system where elders can be protected from neglect and that DHS can continue to investigate those issues, and that is not then, that responsibility is not assigned to, say, the Patient Safety Commission. And so there is, you know, obviously a lot of discussion and a lot of threshing out of issues that would need to happen, I think.
Okay. Perfect. Any questions from the committee? Anyone on the phone? So thank you for that work and the presentation, and again, Chana, for putting things together in such an easy format to follow. With that, we'll get an update from the subcommittee on quality of care. Jeff Aiken.
Thank you very much. Excuse me. So we've been working pretty hard as a committee on just those ideas on how we can really attack this very broad topic. One of the areas we immediately landed on, how ironic that I'm the one presenting it right now, that it's around background checks and making sure that we have really safe individuals providing care to people in long-term care. So as everyone is aware, DHS, Pharma Human Services, currently runs background checks for all the individuals that provide care. And over the past 4 years, there's been multiple legislative actions. There's been a lot of significant work streamlining the systems, improving safety outcomes. And just last February, we passed House Bill 4151, where we're creating like a background check registry, for lack of a better term, so that people, you know, will pass a background check and be ready to work, and we'll have a little more oversight over future activity that that individual has. And so we wanted to talk about and update everyone on a concept that many people are familiar with, but it's called a RAPVAC, R-A-P-VAC. It's not an acronym, it's just RAPVAC. And it's kind of a natural evolution of the system that's coming out of House Bill 4150. What it does is require fingerprint-based criminal records check and then retention of that subject individual's fingerprint. Once the individual is subscribed to the RAPVAC system, Department of Human Services will receive notification of subsequent arrests of this individual. It significantly streamlines the background check systems, nearly eliminates the need for rechecks, active rechecks, because there'll be a continuous evaluation of the individual's criminal records. And it creates a system, that actively monitors all of these individuals. We, in 2013, introduced House Bill 2828 to allow for the development and implementation of a RAPVAC system, and the bill was unsuccessful for a variety of reasons. Privacy concerns, technological concerns, and some unanswered questions around the federal system. But technology is not a legislation such as House Bill 3330 out of 2013, which as moving fingerprint capture and submission to an electronic process. It brought us to a point where it's appropriate, we believe, to reintroduce the concept. Department of Human Services was recently awarded a grant from the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services that will really allow for focused efforts on the system. Our ultimate goal with this is just to increase the safety of people who live in long-term care and to really help build a mobile employment base of people who are ready to provide care, and we know have a measure of safety. So that's kind of a really quick overview. Does anyone have any immediate questions or anything?
Anyone on the phone? Okay.
Thank you.
With that, we're going to move to an update from the subcommittee on financial exploitation. Betsy Steinberg and Lori Rowe, talking about bank freeze.
Thank you, Representative Boyle.
if you go to page 9, that's where I think on your slides it talks about bank freezes. This was actually something that our committee looked at the suggestion of both Lori and myself, and as well as other people who gave testimony. Currently, there isn't anything in place for financial institutions to prevent or stop a transaction if financial exploitation is suspected. We kind of do this little song and dance to try to protect the assets while we either do file reporting or contact or do our own internal review on the issue. And again, the benefit of this is it would allow the financial institution time to conduct an internal review and investigation, contact secondary signers or agents, further provisions on the account. Oftentimes, you already have things already in place at the request of our customer that if we do see something happening, we're supposed to contact this individual or whatever. It's part of their estate planning. It would give us time to follow through on those instructions, or else also in some cases file a report with either the law enforcement or Adult Protective Services if warranted. And if this legislation were drafted appropriately, it would be an effective tool for us to, you know, in our prevention of financial exploitation. Some of the things we've discussed, though, it has to be flexible. It should give us the ability to freeze either a specific transaction or the whole account. Sometimes it's not in the best interest of the victim to freeze a whole account. For example, at our discretion, we may choose to pay some of the everyday living expenses. You wouldn't want to withhold those funds for that individual. It just depends, again, on a case-by-case basis. The time frame should also not be specific or restricted to a specific period of time. These investigations, as I think was pointed out in some materials we looked at, it was, I can't find it right now, it was from OAAPI. It was a wonderful report on financial exploitation that was presented on September 10th, 2014. They take time and to resolve, especially if you're trying to get a conservatorship in place or some other means for somebody to step in. So again, it would be nice to not be held to 5 days to get to move the earth. And the final thing that I think we are looking for is a safe harbor for provision with respect to liability for institutions and staff who freeze transactions on an account. So again, there are, I think, some outlines here on page, let's see, page 9 and page 10. There were some concerns, and really not going to go into the full detail. Banks are not currently mandatory reporters of elder abuse. There was some discussion about tying provision for that in with the actual use of a bank freeze. I would counter that's not always appropriate. It's not always in the best interest of the individual or really necessary to file such a report. And and then there was some discussion what unintended consequences may the freeze law have. And I think there were some examples where they said where whole accounts have been frozen and really unnecessarily. And that's why we're looking for something with a little more flexibility where we could actually freeze a specific transaction or allow certain transactions to go through. And the outcome, there is a recommendation by our committee to adopt a bank freeze law. The work group determination, we need to work on the desirability of mandatory reporting by banks. I think that's something that, you know, would be better off discussed by the subcommittee for a final recommendation. And so I think that's pretty much what I've got to report. Mm-hmm. Lori, do you have?
Just to piggyback, thank you, Betsy. Truly, currently, as it works now, team members are always on the lookout to identify any of the vulnerable situations, whether it's with regard to elders or not. And the freeze aspect is a key piece here to our ability to enact any efforts to protect these vulnerable people based on our investigations, which Betsy points out can take some time. We already currently do reach out as appropriate to law enforcement or to DHS when we do deem necessary. But again, we're looking for something that can be that win-win and continue the protection element, while at the same time not tying the hands of both banks or credit unions, any financial institutions that are out there looking to execute best practice and safety and soundness for their consumer. So it's something that, again, we really want to support, but we want to find a way that will make it work. As everyone knows, anytime you do implement any type of act or action, it can influence human behavior. And so if we were to say mandatory reporting, that could lead some folks to be fearful of that. What might that mean for them with regard to their own job, their job protection, other things? We want to ensure that they are supported in a way to continue the good due diligence they're doing today and not, as I said, have their hands tied, that you absolutely have to report under every condition because it is extremely situational. We need to define what that should look like.
In fact, I would add banks are in a mode right now, financial institutions, through the regulatory environment, for when there's mandatory reporting requirements like Bank Secrecy Act, we get into this protection mode where we do defensive reporting. So there's a tendency to do overkill. So that's something that we're kind of afraid of. I just know that that would be a reaction of our industry. And you don't want to dilute the reports that are actually made. Banks are actually doing a very good job of reporting. According to this report, next to families, we're the largest reporters of financial exploitation. And so banks are doing a good job in Oregon of reporting. We're just asking for some additional tools.
Exactly. So. It was a good discussion at the committee level. Very good.
Okay, any questions on this from the panel? Anyone on the phone? Okay, with that, restitution. Aaron
and Aaron.
They're two different names, although sometimes they sound
just
the same.
Boy and the girl version.
My sister's name is Aaron, and sometimes
they misspell it.
Yeah, okay. Your son's name is Aaron. So you sort of sounds the same.
Okay.
Who's going to start first?
That would be me. Yeah, Aaron. And co-chairs, thanks for having me. My name is Aaron Knott. I am the legislative director for the Attorney General in the Department of Justice. So back in our own process in May, we started work on a legislative concept in response to a case called State v. Patton, which came out in 2010. Basically, what happened in Patton is a defendant stole just under $19,000 from their elderly grandfather, and they reached a plea agreement which included an understanding that they would pay restitution to their grandfather. And in between the entry of that plea agreement and a hearing on restitution, the grandfather passed away. And so the lawyers for the grandfather pressed forward with a restitution claim saying that it should pass from the grandfather to the estate. The defense objected. That went up on appeal, and the Court of Appeals agreed with the defense, finding that an estate is not considered a person under the relevant definition under Oregon law, which is confined to just people as we understand them, public, private corporations, unincorporated associations, or government agencies. An estate is none of the above. So we started putting that concept together. We've already submitted legislative concept language, but we became aware that you were interested in it. We are happy to share, so we brought it before the Subcommittee on Financial Exploitation. What we propose to do makes really two changes. Rather than going after a broadening of the definition of person, which I'll tell you would be complicated, we just want to make an addition to the definition of victim solely for the purposes of the restitution statute. So that's pretty simple. Under the definition of victim, in addition to victim being the person against whom a defendant has committed a criminal offense, if that person suffers economic damages, it would now also include that person's estate. Similarly, we are aware of cases where the estate itself becomes the victim of a crime and may be entitled to restitution. We think it's pretty murky about whether they'd be able to make a claim now, so it's a good opportunity to add that into the statute as well. So there's a separate provision that makes it clear that an estate standing alone that is a victim of crime would have the same rights. So we haven't gotten the language back from legislative counsel yet. We had good conversations in the subcommittee. We've talked to Ms. Olson, who's provided feedback, Gail Meyer from OCDLA, the District Attorneys Association, and there are a few things left, but I'm pretty confident we're going to get to where we need to be to make an ultimate referral. So unless there are questions, I'll turn it over to the other Aaron.
I don't have a whole lot to add. Simplicity is the key, and I think practical application for criminal law practitioners is also important. We're trying to avoid any conflict with the probate code, which is a bit of a challenge since we're trying to see that the people who would benefit financially upon someone's death are the people that should be getting the restitution. We have situations where people die without a will, they die with a will, or they die with a trust because they didn't want their natural heirs to inherit their property. So figuring out how to make all that work is more complex than just adding estates as definitions of victims.
All right. Any questions? Committee, on the phone. Thank you. I think this is simplicity is the key. This is a really important fix because people shouldn't be able to get away with theft and victimizing people. That's wrong. So this is fantastic.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, Gail Meyer.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I think I'm reporting on yet a different little issue. Parenthetically, let me just add that as to the situation with redefining who was a victim in the context of a restitution statute, we're completely in agreement there needs to be a hole, that we need to plug that hole that otherwise existed in existing statutes. So we don't see a problem going forward with that. On September 4th, I participated in a conference call with Detective Matt Smith, who I understand is not on the phone today, but I think I can accurately cue up his concerns. As an investigator with the Forest Police Department, he had a problem. There were times when he was investigating a potential claim of elder abuse. The elder was incapable of communicating with law enforcement, but he had every good reason to believe something nefarious criminal was ongoing. Money was getting stripped out of this person's account. Detective Smith would go to his local prosecutor and request a search warrant, and the prosecutor would want to know, well, who's the suspect and where's the situs of the crime? Usually you get your search warrant to search for things in the crime where you think the crime occurred or where the thing is. And the detective would have to say, I really don't know. I suspect something. It's probably cyber fraud, but I don't know who the suspect is, and I don't know where the situs of the offense is. So the detective's initial instinct was to look at venue statutes, and I will just simply say venue, it can get very complicated because there's constitutional protections in both the state and the federal constitution for where a crime should be prosecuted. But we did agree on a fix that works for the detective, and I think that all hands are now in support of this fix. So what it is that we created a fix in the search warrant statutes themselves. So when there's an investigation ongoing of suspected elder abuse, the victim is incapable of accurately relating or communicating to law enforcement what occurred and where the situs of the potential criminal act was. And either the identity of the suspect is known or the location of the suspect is known. So typically in cyber fraud, you don't know who you're dealing with and you don't know where they are. In those instances, the search warrant, the fix would be the search warrant statute would authorize the issuance of the search warrant in the county of the victim. And that would be the change. Usually you have to make sure that the search warrant is being issued from the county where you think the thing is, what you're searching. But in this instance, we do a carve out in that discrete area. And the detective said that would handle his problem well. And it certainly avoids any of the constitutional implications of further addressing venue of where the ultimate prosecution would be.
So first of all, I want to thank you and Detective Smith for working together to come up with a solution that just makes sense. And, you know, given how businesses transacted and crimes happen these days. So very much appreciate that. And also your work on the restitution.
Thank you, Coach.
That proposal. So this sounds great, pretty straightforward, something that the entire group has said that they would be willing to address, should be addressed. Any questions from the committee?
No question, but comment, Fred Steele with Department of Human Services, and I mean, personally, I was thankful from a department standpoint, thankful that Detective Smith brought this issue up and had these conversations. This is a problem for Adult Protective Services too, and in particular in those cases where there's a criminal element and they're trying to work with law enforcement, and even for Adult Protective Services, who should investigate, where to investigate, kind of getting into the venue even for them, but really it gets down to when there's a criminal element, which law enforcement should they be working with? And I think this is going to vastly improve those cases where, again, we don't know where the suspect is or the perpetrator in an abuse context for APS context. But thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank
you. Co-Chair Gilliam, would you like to talk to us about law enforcement training?
I would. Madam Co-Chair, but I have to point out that I knew this would happen. One of the senators has taken over my co-chair role, and I'm happy with that. I respect both of them very much. I don't know if the folks on the phone know that both our senators here because they didn't have a chance to identify.
Oh, that's true. I'm sorry. How could I forget the Senate? I try every day.
Forget the Senate.
There it is. So would you want to introduce yourself?
I was hoping you would, but it's okay.
Senator Arne Roblin, why don't you tell them where you represent? It's a
Senator Arne Roblin, I represent the Senate District 5, which starts at the bridge in Charleston, Oregon, and ends on 3rd Street in Tillamook. So it's about two-thirds of the Oregon coast, and goes in the valley to Fall City and Sheridan without hitting Willamina, which is always exciting, since you have to go through it to get from one to the other. But it is a large district on the Oregon coast that has a beautiful place to visit. And we'd like people to come and visit and spend their money there.
And Senator Knope.
Thank you, Chair Hoyle. My district includes Redmond, Bend, Tumalo, and Sun River.
Nice. So who would like to talk about law enforcement training?
I would.
Okay.
You can have the other kind of co-chair.
We're both, when I say both, Gail and I are both filling in for the detective. He's got very large shoes. As we all know, he's been a very, very valuable member of this committee from the very beginning. He can't be with us today, but I think we all know how many sacrifices he's made to be in Salem or be on the phone. I will be brief and tell you just the sort of talking points from what he provided as it relates to law enforcement training. He points out that all new law enforcement officers go through a 16-week academy training over right here in Salem at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. He also points out that enforcement officers must do continuing training through that same center. But some elder abuse investigation training is available online, but it is not required. And I think he felt, and the subcommittee felt, that it should be. New recruits, he points out, undergo limited training in elder abuse crimes and investigations. He speaks again from a place of authority, since this is what he does full-time. Limited training leads to under investigation and limited prosecutions. So I think we need to underline that if we don't train law enforcement, how can they know how to investigate all the kinds of things we have been discussing over these last 4 years? So the group recommends that working with law enforcement community, including that Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, DPSST, that we create or increase mandatory elder abuse training hours for law enforcement. And I would have to say this is an important tool and something I know mandatory training is a difficult thing to layer on, but I think I don't know of a more important area that we could add to their expertise. And so that's our recommendation, Co-Chair.
Perfect. Questions, comments from the committee or the phone? Great. Uniform Power of Attorney Act, Fred Steele, back to you.
One thing I think is evident, and I think we are already aware of it in discussions with the Elder Abuse Prevention Work Group, but for those in the room, obviously there's a number of financial exploitation related recommendations and proposals. That last Wednesday, the Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigations within DHS released a financial exploitation study and report, officially released last Wednesday, although it had been floating around for about a week before that, identifying a number of the problems and issues within the 969 cases of substantiated financial exploitation in 2013. That's about it. So we have, within our elder abuse definition, we have eight categorized areas of elder abuse. One of those is financial exploitation, but in our community, non-facility setting statewide, one-third of all substantiations are financial exploitation, a huge problem. Within that financial exploitation study, it also demonstrates or identifies that in 2013, about 20% of those financial exploitation cases, so extrapolated out, and it is statistically significant study, extrapolated out, you have about 195 cases of financial exploitation directly related to abuse using a power of attorney. That is an agent that is financially exploiting a senior in most cases, and the way APS investigates some of those cases might be a person with a physical disability, but for the most part, seniors that are being financially exploited directly related to powers of attorney and uses of powers of attorney. So within our subgroup on financial exploitation, I've had a lot of discussions in our four or five meetings on power of attorney reform or possible power of attorney reform as a starting point for those conversations, looking at what is called the Uniform Power of Attorney Act, developed in, I think finalized, as I understand it, in 2006 from the Uniform Laws Commission at a national level, but using that as a starting point. You know, there's three slides in the handout that do go into, you know, some quick detail, but very important detail that recognizing that the Uniform Power of Attorney Act developed at that national level is intended to balance the principal in a power of attorney, the person that's, you know, that being the person that's giving the power to another to make financial decisions for them, balancing their needs and duties and obligations, or the duties and balancing their needs with the duties and obligations of the agent, that is the person that's receiving the power to make financial decisions, also balancing it with the third parties and individuals or entities such as a bank or credit union, real estate, mortgages, just wherever financial transactions might occur, and their third party role in accepting or rejecting, in some cases, powers of attorney. That's what the Uniform Act was attempting to do, I would say, in large degree. When you look at, as one of the slides recognizes, in Oregon, our power of attorney statutes are minimal, I would say, but that's, I think, deferring to, or what's commonly understood is that a lot of power of attorney law in Oregon is based in case law. So it's not that things are necessarily missing in the law and the way powers of attorney are used or recognized in Oregon. It's just a matter of where do we need to tackle this problem of power of attorney abuse. And so we've had those discussions, but as, again, one of the slides show, that there are some concerns. There are concerns that the Uniform Act arguably goes too far for the duties and obligations or the recognition and some of the allowances for duties and obligations of agents in a power of attorney in the way third parties accept or reject those powers of attorney. So continuing those discussions is the plan. I mean, that is the recommendation of whether the Uniform Act is the way to go. Maybe there's elements within the Uniform Power of Attorney Act that we can adopt to address this problem as we're seeing it and identifying it in this financial exploitation report with the use of power of attorney in Oregon. And I think in general there's been some contentious conversations, but hopefully constructive and productive conversations going forward. So.
Okay, any questions, comments? All right, thank you. Ellen Clem, you're up on the phone. Notarization.
Hi.
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 Welcome.
Good morning.
Yeah.
Hello from Flint, Michigan.
Oh, wow. That's not something we hear very often.
That's true.
Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I will be brief. I have a little bit of a cold still, but
you know, I just wanted to say thank you for having me and allowing me to participate by phone. And I'm going to talk very briefly about notarization. We had a really great meeting in early July. We heard from the Secretary of State's office, and they talked to us about notaries and some new legislation that passed last year. And so as a group, we chatted about several things, all of which are highlighted on your slides here, including all powers of attorneys to be notarized, making notaries mandatory reporters, again, back to the issue of training more professionals, training professionals on what elder abuse looks like, and so that was one of the issues that we had chatted about as a group. And so, you know, we've just been continuing our conversations on this. And then last time we met, which was last week, we chatted about the new legislation that passed last year, and Kevin Christensen brought up that we should take a deeper dive into that. So I think we're going to be asking legislative counsel to do that for us. So, you know, the gist of my report back to the group is that we're still looking at this issue, lots of different things to explore. You know, should we have all POAs notarized? I don't know, you know. There is some concern that even if they are notarized, there still is a potential for abuse. So those conversations are ongoing.
Perfect. Any questions for Ellen out there in Flint, Michigan? On the phone? All right. Thank you. And thank you again for calling in while you're away.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Finally, Judge Burton, Fred Steele on Power of Attorney Registry.
Sure, I'd be happy to start. So as I think we all know, Oregon is a leader in many areas, the bottle bill, vote by mail, and in the Pulse Registry. And your handout, probably everyone here knows this, but Pulse stands for Physician Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment. And basically the way that concept works is that an individual in consultation with their physician can make directions about what kind of resuscitation or what kind of care they want if they're not capable of expressing their desires or consenting to treatment. Both the patient and the physician sign that form. It's entered in a registry, which is a database. And then should that person show up in a hospital or being picked up by an ambulance and they're not able to communicate their desires, those folks can check the registry and know what this person's desires are and honor them. And so we talked a little bit about whether we could use that concept with powers of attorney. As you've already heard from Fred, from Betsy and Lori, one of the issues that came up as we discussed the Uniform Power of Attorney Act, and maybe the biggest issue, is that because there isn't any really clear standard for when they're good and when they're not good, oftentimes banks and other third parties that are asked to accept them are reluctant to do so. And on the one hand, they stop a lot of elder abuse that way because they say this transaction doesn't look good and we're not going to honor it. And on the other hand, sometimes people who have very carefully thought out, this is who I want to manage my affairs if I'm incapacitated, and they've filled out this form and they think that they've made their plan, and then it turns out when that form is needed, it can't be honored. So we were looking at the tension between how do you make sure that the good ones are honored and the not good ones are not honored. And so it is still definitely a work in progress as a concept, but the idea was something similar to POLST, where the individual in consultation with somebody, and who exactly that should it be a doctor, should it be a lawyer, who that should be with, fills out their power of attorney. The idea being that consultation with that third party is a little bit of a check against identity theft and against abusing someone who maybe does not have financial capacity, that once that is done, that gets entered into this registry. And then once it's in the registry, banks and third parties can know that they can rely on it, and the person who has planned ahead can know that their wishes will be honored. And I think the decision was that's a concept that still needs some work. There are a number of challenges for that, and those are listed on page 18
the slide on page 18. So I think the decision was it's a conversation that we would keep having.
Perfect. Questions or comments? Phone? Great. Well, that's all of the updates from the subcommittees. And I think one of the nicest things about serving on this committee is that a lot of the work does happen in the subcommittees, and it's pretty focused. And we try not to move forward with things that, you know, can't get done. And again, try and move forward things that actually will make a difference. So I know everyone's put a lot of time into making sure that these recommendations that come forward, you know, are vetted. So I want to thank everyone for that. And with that, Fred Steele, do you want to talk about wings?
Yes, I would love to talk about wings. And so again, Fred Steele, Department of Human Services, and I've talked about, I kind of mentioned at some of our recent work group meetings and possibly off and on over the last year since the formation of WINGS. And WINGS stands for Working Interdisciplinary Network of Guardianship Stakeholders. So I'll try to keep this brief, but just to more formally present this work that's ongoing and many stakeholders that are involved in, Chana included in the handouts here, the membership list, and you can see the number of individuals, entities, you know, including a number of lay fiduciaries, those that are actually serving as family guardians or conservators for individuals, you know, for family members, quite frankly, unpaid guardians, that are contributing to this work. And I want to just briefly touch on how it relates to elder abuse prevention in particular. So in the handout, I do provide a brief background. There was an opportunity that was presented by the National Guardianship Network for an incentive grant of $7,000, so not a whole lot of money. But as we learned, there's a lot that you can do with $7,000. And it was from their perspective at a national level to implement in a number of states. And so they were looking at four states in particular. They wanted to identify four states to kind of create live versions of a concept that was developed at a national kind of task force committee hearing or meeting back in 2011. So we applied. We were one of, I believe, it nine states that applied, and we were awarded the one of the four grants. And what that did was, again, it provided us a platform to bring, we have about 30 to 35 stakeholders around across Oregon and across our different disciplines to work on guardianship and conservatorship issues. And that was the starting point. But as we've gone forward, we really are looking at all guardianship, conservatorship, and alternatives to guardianship, conservatorship. So those fiduciary relationships and the system that supports those in Oregon. So just as an example, and the easy example to give of what we're trying to achieve is to look at myself and my role within the Department of Human Services and in part the work that I do around our long-term care, long-term service and support system, and bringing to the table from my perspective how guardianships, conservatorships, these fiduciary relationships can better support individuals. If we have a healthy infrastructure in place of this system, that we can better support individuals to live in you know, less restrictive settings, so more in their home, more in their community-based care settings, and have the proper supports in place. But doing so where they're not going to be taken advantage of or neglected, or say the power of attorney as one of those alternatives to conservatorship, that the person is not going to be financially exploited. So we're through this group looking very focused on those fiduciary relationships. We had our first meeting and formed for the first time, came together as a group in August 2013, so just a little over a year ago. By the end of 2013, we had established three work groups in particular to carry out the substantive work. And then I have on this handout here the products that we've established, that we've created to date. So a lot of it, I would say a lot of the work that we're focusing on going forward, or at least to date, is a lot of training, education, and supports. And we're looking at, you know, as identified by the work groups, you know, we have a work group focused on supporting the professionals that engage in particular, guardianship and conservatorship systems, and not professional guardians per se, although they are included in that, but also attorneys, judges, medical professionals, you know, caregivers in long-term care settings, and so on, really trying to identify potential supports for all of those individuals. You know, one thing not identified on this handout, just as an example in support of all of those individuals, is that that work group is in the process, as their next project, their second project, putting together kind of a foundational training to build on. You know, they developed a brief informational brochure in the grant period, which ended at the end of March of 2014. But so the grant period, we're able to have a product that met the grant needs, but going forward, actually developing a foundational training that can be used for attorneys or judges or caregivers across the system to better educate individuals and those that are interacting with, again, guardians, conservators, and other agents in fiduciary relationships so that they can be better educated. We have a work group that's very focused on family and the lay guardians, the non-professionals, but also just family and lay individuals, even in a power of attorney relationship. Representative payee, we do have a representative from the Social Security Administration from the state that's a part of our work and very engaged in the work that we're doing, just as a, you know, another one of those fiduciary relationships. And then also the our third work group focused on protected person advocacy, which is, you know, so you have protected person specifically in your guardianship conservatorship. That is the person that, as they're defined in statute, that is going to be under the guardian. They're having a guardian or conservator appointed for them to make sure that they're, you know, we have a work group dedicated to their voice, their interests, their needs, and advocacy for them. Going forward, what we're hoping to continue to accomplish, of what's not stated on here, just as some additional examples of our work going forward, is supporting, you know, what I see us in doing it somewhat abstractly. We're not a formal blessed group outside of just the stakeholders coming together, but supporting what I would hope is continued expansion of the state public guardian program and what was established just in February, supporting expansion where it's needed or appropriate going forward of that House Bill 4114 volunteer guardian monitoring program that was essentially blessed by the legislature in February. Looking forward to working with the pilot program that's been establishing over the last 2 years in Portland, the SAVO program, the Special Advocates for Vulnerable Oregonians, essentially your CASA for seniors or CASA for adults and those in guardianship conservatorship relationships. And looking to support expansion of that statewide and you know, at least in those counties where it might be appropriate and necessary and needed. So as much as we're working on training, educational material type work, also looking at, you know, those broader long-term needs of the system and doing it from a collective, collaborative platform. So
impressive what you've done in a year, Fred. Can I go back to products for a second? Maybe I missed this. What form does the third product, a person-centered planning tool, what form has that taken?
So we're near final. I actually had thought we were on final version of that here about 3-4 weeks ago. It's taken a little while to finalize. And so what we've done is there's about a 12-13-page guide. Within that guide is a tool, about a 3-4-page tool that is intended for, especially in a guardianship conservatorship setting, for the guardian to fill out the tool and better understand who their protected person is, especially one that possibly doesn't have capacity, possibly doesn't have the ability to communicate anymore, so that they can recognize in filling out that tool, they can recognize the decisions that that person would have made for themselves. So looking at their social needs, their social history, medical history, medical needs, just trying to put it all in a simple tool and something to reflect back on, something to go back to every 6 months, maybe once a year, to just identify the, you know, changing needs, but to get to a point of trying to make decisions as that person would have made for themselves. So that's, I'm actually very excited about that tool once we get it finalized. It's been complicated, as you might imagine, trying to put together something that's going to be a decision-making tool for individuals statewide. So we're almost done with it.
That's great. It's very exciting.
When is it going to be publicly available, the tools?
Well, the other two, we've produced those in part using half of the $7,000 incentive grant. And so I actually have a brochure and then the booklet of the fiduciary relationships and the brief explanations. And we did create, using at least a temporary site with the State Unit on Aging and a website that I have control over, where we have a collection of resources. So there's brief explanations in those booklets, and we do have those published. And I've handed them out at this work group, but probably not as probably the work group meetings where we haven't had quite as quite a large attendance. But I do have those two in particular, and then refer to the for more explanation. This collection of resources, which then takes you out to other information and resources that exist in Oregon. But prior to this one website and through this initiative of WINGS, there wasn't a single collection of resources. It was more piecemeal and Googling and trying to find what you could just in Oregon to understand Oregon-specific laws, Oregon-specific relationships of these fiduciary relationships. So it's slowly becoming available, and we're still formalizing how that's going to look going forward, and I for example, trying to identify a permanent website rather than the temporary one that I have set up. But
any comments from any of the co-chairs?
All I would say is I'm impressed every time I come back for the same reasons you mentioned earlier, that the work gets done by these subcommittees, and I really do appreciate that effort that's put in, and you can actually hear in the testimony of the passion that people bring to their job, and I appreciate that as a legislator.
Excellent. Any other comments or questions?
Hi, my name is Rosie Vanderhoven. Can you folks hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, great. I am a geriatric care coordinator in Bend, and I also appreciate all the great work that's going on in these hearings. I do have a question, though. A couple of times, I think I heard mention of a financial exploitation report that was recently released. Wanted to know if that is also available to the public.
Yes, it's available to the public, and I wish I could point you directly to the Department of Human Services webpage, but I'm sure it's probably, because it's recent release just last week, it's probably on the front page of the Department of Human Services webpage.
Chana, can you get that out to everybody on the committee and then put it, link it into the resources for this committee hearing?
Absolutely.
All right. So
that would be great. Thank you.
We'll get that to you, and then it'll be online on OLIS under resources for this committee hearing.
Thank you.
Great question.
I was just going to say that usually you and I are accused of winging it. Ben, I was just so happy that Fred did that
today. You're welcome.
He's learning. We're helping him pick up bad habits. Fortunately, we have Chana to keep us in line. So with that, I just want to thank everyone for their time, and I will close this informational meeting of the Elder Abuse Prevention Work Group. Prevention Work Group.